Hello.
We always test the microphone levels before we start, which might surprise you,
I was just
but
thinking you really starting the podcast
I know we always sound like Adele. Hello. What a treat. I'm sitting with the wokest man in
way.
Pomperani.
Really not.
I absolutely loved that on Sunday. Woke. I don't even know what it means. So, you're more down with people than I am, Matt. So how'd you like?
I had to Google it, but it's kind of enlightened in a very postmodern way, I guess.
Oh, big words as well.
That probably doesn't help at all, but
No. So nice. We are looking at Revelation 17 and 18, which are two, hefty passages. I keep trying to get more Revelation language into my life. They are beasts of passages.
Very good.
Very big. Oh, you can't say very good and not laugh. But sorry, let's dive straight in. What's the score with these seven horns and kings and the other 10 kings? Because there's pretty unusual language in this passage in particular.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say there are lots of interpretations of
Shock.
this one between the different schools of thought, but also within the different schools of thought. So, for example, some people see seven of Rome's emperors here, in the seven horns, the seven kings, or they see them as seven different kingdoms. And the 10 kings then have been seen as, for example, the 10 provincial governors of Rome, which I found out this week. Thought that was
Wow.
interesting. One interesting interpretation.
I'm glad that went to the cutting room floor just as a side note.
Or more generally, and I think I lean towards the more sort of general end here, that they're seen as symbolic of the power of the kings of the earth generally, which I think is probably the way to go. So even if it would have made the first hearers think of particular Roman emperors or particular kingdoms, it's probably talking about the kings of the earth rulers generally in every generation. And that's what I'd say. In line with our approach, I'd avoid identifying them with particular kingdoms, but I'd see them as representing rulers and states across history. Having said all that, that I take in kind of a general whole church age thing, as usual, I do think as we're getting later on in Revelation here, we're starting to see more and more emphasis on the return of Jesus and what happens just before. So I think it's likely that the eighth king that's mentioned here, and the fact that the 10 kings have authority for 1 hour, very short period, and that they will wage war against the Lamb, all that is probably starting to bring us into Armageddon territory, pointing to events right before the return of Christ. So remember that we've been saying that each vision cycle has reference to the whole church age, but then, especially later in Revelation, as we get towards the end of each section, there's increasing emphasis on the very end, what happens just before the return of Jesus and what happens with the return of Jesus.
So, progressive parallelism.
Hey, spot
I
on, yeah.
nearly got that word right.
So one of the labels we're using for our approach is parallelism, because each vision cycle parallels the others. But then I think it's Greg Beale says there's a progressive parallelism. I guess you picked that up from Beale, which means that there's a progression in those cycles to focus more and more on the very end.
I ordered Beale's commentary January 1st. Still
You
no
still haven't
sign.
got it,
Still no sign of
mate. You're going to get it just when we finish
I
Revelation. You
know.
know that, don't
Absolutely melted,
you?
but I suppose the progressive parallelism is really good because as we get to each end of cycle, you think, oh, that's pretty bleak, but each time you're getting a little bit more Jesus, a little bit more hope, a little bit more the end is coming. So I suppose that's where that view is particularly, well, not view, but the way Revelation is structured, it's really encouraging to have it that way, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, having said that, one of the things we were chatting about earlier is that I think what becomes also more obvious is the reality of judgment and hell, which is something we're going to have to talk about before we get to the end. But yes, gloriously, more and more emphasis on Jesus returning and the eternal hope.
Yeah, because touching on that sort of evil and judgment thing in verses 16 and 18 of chapter 17, we see that the beast and Babylon consume or destroy one another. Is that just the way evil is? Like, could you explain that? Do they just consume one another?
Yeah, I think it is basically just the way evil is. You know, this isn't, we're talking about the dragon, the devil, using these different agents, the beast and the second beast and Babylon. And it's not like they're one big happy team. You know, what the devil does is destruction and exploitation. He wants to destroy not only the church, but anything that's been made in God's image, anything that's been made to God's glory, he wants to destroy. So it shouldn't surprise us that Satan, in his rage, because he's been defeated at the cross, will ultimately cast off and destroy even those agents that he's been using for his ends. So this is showing us, isn't it, that evil turns against evil. That's what we're seeing here, that the devil doesn't reward those who serve him.
It's like in the Dark Knight, the second Batman film.
Oh, here we go.
At the very start, you know, you have all the evil people trying to rob the bank. Mm. And just one at a time, they kill each other off because they don't need one another anymore. And you're like, there's just, well, no loyalty among thieves, is there? But that's sort of, that's what Jesus says it, isn't it? Like, the thief comes to kill, destroy, etc.
Yeah.
Which, whatever you kept talking Sunday about how, you know, this is our greatest danger, seduction. Seduction leads to death. I suppose that's really striking, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, you know, we've had some heavy passages, haven't we? And it was a heavy passage because that's the emphasis here. It's what evil does. It's what this fallen world does to those in it, but apart from Christ.
Yeah. So in this passage, in chapter 18, there's a lot of, you know, chat about economy. And, you know, if you turn on BBC News, there's always stuff about the budget or economy going on. So whenever we read this, how much of this is a warning against money and wealth, and how much is imagery?
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a warning against loving money and wealth here in these chapters, along with the dangers of a lot of other seductions. I think what we're seeing in chapter 18 is that this fallen world system has always been and is built hugely on economics, on commerce, on trading things, buying and selling. It's been like that since the beginning. People have always traded and bartered and bought and sold things. I mean, it's important to say not everything about that system, that economic system, is bad. Mm. In God's mercy and his common grace, that there are good things and blessings even in this fallen world. But at the end of the day, if the whole world order is under the control of the evil one, then he's able to use economics and finance, as well as things I very quickly mentioned on Sunday, like culture and art. Mm. Anything else in this world, he's able to use those things in his designs to draw people away from God. Not because those things, whether it's economics, money, art, culture, not because those things are bad in themselves, but because the devil's got a foothold in the sinful human heart. And like to paraphrase John Calvin, I think it is, the human heart is an idol factory. We're just constantly manufacturing idols. We all by nature worship things and worship ourselves instead of worshipping God. And the devil is a skilled user of means, as we've been seeing, and he can skew the workings of economics and culture and art, all these things, to keep people from God. So economics is part of the picture, yeah.
I remember I was in a Bible study, and whenever we got to this passage, the leader was basically saying that this means we should never trade, or we shouldn't, you know, and it talks about cinnamon and cumin and stuff like that. And I was sitting there being like, surely that's like, that can't be what this is about. So
it's impossible to not trade in some way, however simple it is, if you live in community with other human beings. So I don't think we have to read these are the extremes that Christians can go to sometimes, aren't they? That you can go one way or the other, and it's not saying avoid these things. It's asking the question, is the devil using these things in my life to draw me away from Christ and to make me form idols?
Yeah, that's a much better way of understanding it, rather than don't use fajita spice.
I'd be done if I couldn't. I'd have to use spices. And cumin in particular.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sidetrack. You've written in our life group notes that the beast uses the stick whilst Babylon uses the carrot.
Yeah.
Could you perhaps explain that statement? It might be fairly obvious to most of you, but could you explain that statement and then tell us, what does the carrot look like in Cardiff 2021?
Yeah. Well, we saw, didn't we, previously, that the beast stands for states, kingdoms, rulers who oppress the earth's inhabitants and particularly oppress the church. And that's the devil, through the beast, using the stick to achieve his aims in trying to destroy the church, being harsh, using violence, using oppression. That's what you see in chapter 12, where he's trying to destroy the church there. His strategy in using Babylon, which is really just another way of looking at this fallen world, isn't it? Is that the it's the carrot, in that the main approach with Babylon is seduction. People are intoxicated with the contents of her cup rather than full on opposition. I mean, the chapters here do show us that Babylon is complicit in persecution as well, and that fits with what we know from history, that the world political, financial, commercial systems often support tyrannical rulers and vice versa. But the big point in these chapters is that Satan has multiple approaches to persecuting the church and leading people away from God and into idolatry. The beast is the stick because it's violence and oppression. Mm. Babylon is more subtle and seductive, and that's the carrot. Very blunt way of putting it, but that's where I was coming from with that.
Okay, I see. So the carrot for us in 2021 is anything that makes... Well, Kevin DeYoung always uses it, you know, something about sin is whatever makes righteousness look weird. Mm. I think that was, well, yeah. I definitely butchered his quote there. I might look it up.
No, but I think that's the gist. I remember that from Hole and Holiness. Yeah, right? Yeah, something like that.
That's
yeah.
the one.
So, Kevin DeYoung's not listening.
Yeah, maybe. Bless him.
Very, very broad paraphrase.
Yeah. So, in light of that, how are we supposed to fight against Babylon and the world then? Is it a case of becoming a monk? Is that the only way you can't be seduced? Or should we go into holy huddle at the bridge and not have anything to do with the world?
It's very tempting sometimes, isn't it? Depending on your personality, maybe, to just become a monk or a nun. Just, you know.
Yeah.
Well, lots of Christians have taken that approach over the centuries, actually, if not becoming monks, but withdrawing to some degree, sort of a monastic or ascetic approach, ascetic as in, you know, rejecting the pleasures of the world, an approach that cuts believers off from everyday life, from worldly things and worldly pleasures as much as possible. So Christians have done that historically from time to time. I think the idea there is that being is about being utterly different from the world. You know, what those Christians have seen is that God's kingdom is so different from the kingdom of this world, and so Christians should stay separate as much as possible. Now, there's a lot in that thinking that's understandable and even admirable, but it doesn't seem to be a biblically balanced way of thinking if you think it through, because it's true that the system of this world is against God, and we're told not to love the world. In 1 John, John says, do not love this world. But it's equally true, isn't it, that Jesus told his disciples that he was not taking them out of the world, even though they were not of the world. Actually, I've got that marked up. This is John 17, 15 to 18. It's probably worth reading the verses. Jesus says, my prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. For them I sanctify myself, that they may be truly sanctified. So Jesus is saying he's sending his disciples into the world, not drawing them out of it. But at the same time, he's saying they're not of the world. And that's where we get the phrase, as Christians, we should be in the world, but not of the world. Mm. So these are the truths you've got to balance up. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Psalm 24. Even in this fallen world and in the face of a system that misuses these things, we can enjoy, as Christians, the good things that God gives us in this life without fear, whether it's the stuff we mentioned before, art, sport, culture, possession, sex, as long as we enjoy them and use them in obedience to God's word and in faith, we use them in God's way. Mm. Just to use a few other biblical images, just to make the point that we've got to get the balance right. Peter, in his first letter, talks about us being foreigners, exiles, strangers in this world. But we're meant to be living in this world as good exiles and strangers. We're meant to be salt and light, Jesus' words to the disciples. We're told, classic example, we're told to go into the world, to all nations, to share the good news. We can't do that if we separate ourselves from the world. So total engagement isn't an option. Our calling is to be in the world, but not of the world, engaged with the world, but different from the world. So it's so often the case, isn't it, that the biblical approach is a balance between two extremes, and I think that's true here. Of course...
Dare I say it?
Go on and say it.
Both and, not either or.
our unofficial strapline is not either or, it's both and.
Back.
Yeah, that's it, basically, isn't it? Yeah. So, of course, there's the other extreme, which is when professing Christians, people who say they follow Jesus, they're so utterly of the world that they're indistinguishable from the world. They've got the same idols as everybody else, and that's obviously another wrong extreme to go to. They may not be exhibiting really obvious gross sins, but their time and their passion and their energy is totally taken up with the things of the world, and and so they're not being distinctively salt and light. And that's when the voice in Revelation 19 needs to be heard, where we hear the voice, I think the voice of Jesus, saying, come out of her, come out of Babylon, my people.
I've got that quote by Kevin DeYoung. So
I'll go for it.
Butchered it. So, to put it another way, worldliness is whatever makes sin look normal and righteousness look strange.
Mm-hmm.
In every society, there's a principle of Babylon that makes war against the children of God.
Oh, so he mentions Babylon in the quote. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So that's where Revelation 19 language of come out of her is helpful, because in some ways you think, oh, well, I just have to stick. I have to be salt and light in this situation. But there's also the come out of her, the Joseph principle of flee sin.
Mm.
Like, actually recognize that there are areas where you might be weak and it's just too hard for you to be salt and light in that situation. That's something I always find in my rugby team, like identifying the when am I being salt and light and when am I just enjoying the sin that's going on.
Yeah.
It's just something we need to figure out, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned already that there is common grace, so we can enjoy good things, but maybe how do we recognize when we're becoming too consumed by the world, when these good things become God things?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think this is just me, but it can be hard, really hard, to spot that in ourselves. So this is where regular fellowship with other Christians, good, honest Christian friends, is so important. But also it comes back to the stuff we talk about almost every time, the bread and butter stuff of the Christian life, the means of grace. When you're spending time reading and hearing God's word and you're spending time talking to the Lord, you'll start to see when your passion for God is waning, and you'll start to see when your passion for these good things is getting too strong. So it's close Christian fellowship, more importantly, walking close to the Lord. And then also, sort of diagnostic type questions: what gets me out of bed in the morning? So when you get up in the morning, Dave, you don't have to answer this. What's the first thing in your mind? What's the thing that motivates you? Is it primarily the Lord and following Jesus, or is it the other things that gets you excited? And if when I ask myself what gets me out of bed in the morning, it's a long list of things and activities, and God's not on that list, then there's a problem.
Oh. At the moment when my alarm goes off for my early morning workout, I'm like, get me back to bed. I'm all thinking about the Lord, I'm not gonna lie. Well, there's some honesty for me.
Well, exactly. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you don't think of giving areas like that, areas of your life like that, to the Lord, do you? Like, this is just an exercise. This is just something I've got to do.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? If our life's all for Him, for Christ, we can even commit that aspect of it to Him. Though I don't get up early to exercise, so I can't talk.
No. Well, it's that we've been reading this book, and the geese in the book is really the man. I don't know why I said geese. The guy in the book, whenever he goes to exercise, he has like this five-sentence prayer, which is like, it's a brilliant prayer, but it's like, I consecrate this body of exercise to thy will, Lord. I'm like, I can't imagine saying that.
I think an equivalent version would be something like, please, Lord, let this exercise do me good, and please let me not collapse while I'm doing this. You know, it's still giving over that part of your life to the Lord, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. So I need to, you know, not read that prayer out before I do exercise now. Okay. Oh, we're at the end. It's because we get no listener questions these days. It's just us two talking to ourselves.
Yeah, good. Reminder, send us your questions, guys, if you've got them.
So we've sort of talked about it already, but just to hammer it home, how do we use good gifts to glorify God and use them in a way that's distinct and different from the world? Because that's quite hard to do.
Really good question to finish with, I think. Well, it's going to sound like an obvious answer, but by using them biblically. So when I look at the things I've got in my life or available to me, those common grace blessings, if I look at those things, is it, first of all, I ask, is there a biblical command or principle that speaks directly as to how I should use this good gift of God? So if it's sex, which is a good gift of God, that's only to be used in certain ways. In the marriage relationship, marriage between a man and a woman. So that's an obvious one where there's a command that applies. I think also by using these things with thanksgiving. So do I privately and publicly acknowledge the goodness of God in giving this thing? And if I can, and do that, that's a good sign that I'm not being seduced by Babylon, but instead I'm living my life here as a faithful exile whose citizenship is in heaven.
Very interesting. I think whenever I consider how I use my gifts in a way that's distinct and different from the world, too often I get it all wrapped up in, oh, it's just so like the world. It's really just looking for these 1 or 2 percenters at times, isn't it? Like, it's okay for me to have a car. But I remember an elder at one of my previous churches was a big money banker. I remember chatting to him about, you know, how he fights against sin and temptation. He said, well, I have quite an easy sort of temperature gauge on how I'm doing spiritually at times. And it's if I'm going on the same types of holidays, this buying the same types of cars and living in the same type of houses as all the other men I work with, I'm doing something wrong, because it should be noticeable that I'm, you know, driving a small family car rather than, you know, I'm real swanky Merc, which I just thought was like quite a, you know.
Yeah, I find that really helpful, actually.
It's not, you know, that was for him. I suppose we all have to figure out your relation with fear and trembling, but
yeah,
for him that was a very helpful sort of way of saying, well, this is how I know that I'm maybe given enough, or I've thought enough about the way I spend my money.
It's about affections, isn't it, to use that sort of that word in the old-fashioned sense that, say, Jonathan Edwards uses, affection. So what is it I love and I'm passionate about? And trying to assess those affections in my heart. Are my affections most stirred by and for Christ more than these things? So, you know, Jesus says, he doesn't say love. He doesn't say money is the root of all evil, does he? He says the love of money is what stirs my affections.
Mm.
Yeah.
Great. That's us. It's a wee quick one today. So hope you've enjoyed this one.
Yeah, we'll do a double length one next week.
Yeah, we'll probably get feedback saying more 20-minute podcasts.
Well, actually, we need to decide what we're doing for podcast next week, because Jonathan Thomas is preaching to us on Sunday on Psalm 19. So I guess it might be on that, or it might be on something else. We'll keep you posted.
You could have a wee chat with your mate JT, surely.
Do you know, I'm sure we could swing that, yeah. Okay, we'll keep you posted.
Yeah, see you soon.
Bye.